These are the founding physicians of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. They convened to develop highly effective treatment protocols to prevent the transmission of COVID-19 and to improve the outcomes for patients ill with the disease. Today, they want you to know how to prevent COVID-19, even against the variants. This is the molecule of ivermectin, the medicine that can end the pandemic. Ivermectin was discovered and developed in 1975 in Japan by Dr. Satoshi Imura and Dr. William Campbell. In 2015, Drs. Imura and Campbell each received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for ivermectin's discovery. They deserved it. The medicine has brought relief and saved the lives of millions across the globe for nearly 40 years. Ivermectin was first used in humans in 1987 for the treatment of parasitic diseases. It has eradicated pandemics of numerous diseases for four decades. Plus, it has been given safely to nearly 4 billion people worldwide. Ivermectin is on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. It has been deemed to be one of the safest medicines known to mankind. But this workhorse of a drug is not yet finished. In the past 8 months, numerous controlled clinical trials are reporting consistent, large improvements in COVID-19 patient outcomes when treated with ivermectin. People treated with ivermectin experience numerous clinical benefits: less infections, reduced inflammatory markers, more rapid improvement, more rapid viral clearance, shorter hospitalization, and a reduction in mortality. As you can see, ivermectin has been very well studied across the world. In fact, the amount of scientific medical evidence is mountainous. As of July 16, 2021, 60 clinical studies, including 30 randomized controlled trials, have evaluated the role of ivermectin in the treatment or prevention of COVID-19. Here's how it works. Ivermectin inhibits the replication of many viruses, including SARS-CoV-2, influenza, and others. Ivermectin has potent anti-inflammatory properties with multiple mechanisms of action. Ivermectin diminishes viral load and protects against organ damage in animal models of SARS-CoV-2 infection. It prevents transmission of COVID-19 when taken either pre- or post-exposure. It hastens recovery and decreases hospitalization and mortality in patients with COVID-19. And it leads to far lower case fatality rates in regions with widespread use. Then, when ivermectin is used with the additional components in the FLCCC Alliance's iMask Plus protocol, it can work even better in preventing COVID-19. So here is what the FLCCC Critical Care Physician Team recommends. Just like you keep a first aid kit around the house, please start keeping a just-in-case COVID kit. Here is what the kit contains: ivermectin, vitamin D3, vitamin C, quercetin, zinc, melatonin, and gargle or mouthwash. You can find our iMask Plus protocol, plus all of our prevention and treatment protocols, at flccc.net. We wish you a lifetime of good health. What a wonderful summary of why our doctors have included ivermectin in their protocols for both prevention and treatment of COVID-19. And thank you, Joyce Kamen, for producing that video. She worked hard on it today, I can tell you. We will post it on the website shortly. Our new iMask Plus prevention and early treatment protocol is already up. All you have to do is go to the website, flccc.net. Right at the top of the page on the left, you will see a link. It says, here it is, the brand new protocol, and you're going to want to get that. It's important. Welcome to the FLCCC Alliance's weekly update. I am Betsy Ashton, Creative Director of the FLCCC, and I am happy to tell you that tonight we have two of your favorite physicians with us, Drs. Pierre Corey and Paul Marek, both professors and teachers of just great renown and writers and doctors in ICUs who have been studying this disease, really understand it, and they've been studying the variants, and that's very, very important. They have been updating the protocol, and I'm telling you, working hours and hours and hours for the last couple of days, particularly, to see what can work to defeat the Delta variant. And they put it into the new protocol, and they're here to tell you just how they did it and why. So without further ado, Paul, Pierre, are you ready?
Good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Pierre.
I like the shirt.
Wrong color, my friend.
I got the right color. Mine's a little grayer than your. Maybe you're in better light than I am. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But you look good. Yeah, not as good as me, but you know.
You need a little bit of a makeup, my friend.
Yeah, we'll talk about why that is. So anyway, all right, Paul, let's get to business. I got some slides. Let me tee them up. Let's go through them. You're going to interrupt, which is fine. I'm sure it's going to be with really important stuff to say. Okay, so guys, let's talk about this Delta variant because it's given us some problems, but nothing that we can't solve. But just so you guys know, you know, the Delta variant, the reason why everyone's talking about it so much is that it's much more transmissible. And when it transmits, it actually has a much higher viral load. So a study from China in about 170 patients, they measured the viral loads and they compared them to prior studies of the earlier strains. And they're finding like up to 1,000 times higher viral loads. And also from exposure to first symptoms, it's much faster. And then we're seeing, and Paul, you could talk about this clinically, we're seeing a bit faster from first symptoms to presentation in the hospital. Remember, we're mostly in the hospital, although I treat a fair amount of outpatients. I have a large, I'm going to say my practice is friends, family, friends of friends and friends of family and colleagues. And so I'm treating a fair amount of outpatients. But, you know, we are starting to see those in the hospital and they're coming in fairly quick, you know, from first symptoms to the time where they get, you know, low oxygen levels. It's fast. And so it's a little harder to get ahead. I think we can do it. We're trying to sound, you know, heightened vigilance to try to get ahead of this disease, because the more you wait, the later you are, the harder it is to treat. You know, one of the things is that these super spreading events, even amongst the vaccinated, everyone heard about, what is it, Martha's Vineyard or Cape Cod, where there's 74% of them were vaccinated and they had a large number of transmitted infections. And then the other thing that we've seen, and this is what we want to talk about tonight, is we've had some breakthrough infections, just like you heard about the breakthroughs of the vaccines. A lot of people who've been vaccinated are now getting infected. We've had some breakthroughs on our ivermectin prophylaxis protocol, and we think we have an answer for that. So, and then you could just see that if you look at the number of cases. So there was a spike late July, last August, same time of year. If you look at this year compared to last year, it's actually almost 3 to 4 times as much when you look at the early August numbers last year. And the other thing that's really damning is that in between, we've had 300 million vaccine doses. And so you see we're having a very highly transmissible variant that's causing a lot of cases. And we're starting to see them, you know, fill up the ICUs. So it's unfortunate. Paul, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what people need to realize is that this variant is quite a vicious thing. So, you know, the patients we're seeing are younger patients. They are much sicker. This variant, because it replicates so much faster to much higher concentrations, results in a profound inflammatory response. So the patients who are coming in have a profound inflammatory response, and they do not respond as well to our treatment protocol as they previously did. So I think that the caution is that you need to do whatever you can to prevent getting COVID. And at the very first signs that you get COVID, you need to treat yourself. There's absolutely no place for complacency, because this virus replicates rapidly, results. The causal is much accelerated. Patients are coming in much sooner with profound inflammatory response. So it's absolutely critical with this variant that patients are treated early. There's no time for delay. That's why you need a kit at home. And yes, the first sign of COVID, you need to be treated. There really isn't time for a day's delay.
No, we agree. And you know, as the video that Joyce put together early on emphasized that. And so we encourage everyone to, you know, get ready just in case. You know, because of the higher viral loads, the shorter incubation periods, I guess it's a little unsurprising that we had some reports of breakthroughs. I'll go out right and say it. I actually broke through and got COVID last week. My daughter got it, and I got it a couple of days later. I was probably day 7 from my last ivermectin dose. I take it weekly. But I'll tell you what is not unexpected is the fact that my case was pretty mild. And for me, it really felt just like a bad head cold. And I'm a couple days later, I took treatment doses of ivermectin and I'm doing much better. In fact, I feel almost normal again. That's only a couple days later. So, but we have had a couple other breakthroughs. If you guys remember Dr. Boros from last week, he had, I think, one or two reports down in Florida of some breakthroughs. And again, it's not unexpected given the short incubation period. So as a result, we are given this variant, and I didn't even get into the Lambda variant, because what we're hearing about the Lambda, it's also highly transmissible with higher viral loads. And so we think for precaution, our best approach is that we actually think you should do it twice a week now. So like, if you're going to be on the chronic prevention protocol, maybe like a Monday and a Thursday, so twice a week to keep the tissue concentrations and blood concentrations high enough to protect you against these new, more rapidly transmissible variants. And again, this is empiric. We don't have data on this. This is our clinical judgment. This is our rationale. Again, it's a safe drug. We believe that the benefits far outweigh the risks of doing this. And you know, if we have to revisit this and try a different regimen or a higher dose, we will. But for now, we're going to advocate twice a week. Another thing that we're doing, and that's also similar to Dr. Hector Carvalho, who's kind of the expert. He did the big trials down in Argentina. We spoke with him this week, and he had already made some changes to his protocol and that he had increased the doses for post-exposure prophylaxis, right? So if you have someone in the household who gets sick, the household members, or if you've been exposed to someone with COVID, you should take a higher dose. We increased that to 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. So that's our prevention. We're also, for those who like aren't on ivermectin chronically, probably a good practice to start right now is to gargle mouthwash. This has been shown in a number of studies to prevent not only severe illness, but to contract the illness. And so any mouthwash that has cetylpyridinium chloride, there's a few on the market here in the U.S. Listerine with essential oils is also considered vericidal. Or you could use a povidone iodine 1% solution that you'd have to make. But any of these gargles should also mitigate or limit your chance of getting sick. So those are the changes we're going to make to the prevention protocols. And then outpatient, because of these higher viral loads, we've already been kind of moving towards higher doses just clinically. I've been starting higher and higher. Now we're just saying, you know, the lowest you should start is 0.4. And if you have someone who's like, you know, you get to them as a, if I'm talking to physicians now, you know, or providers, if you get someone who's day five or really not doing well or has a lot of comorbidities, you might want to just start at the higher dose. And I've talked to a couple experts around the world lately, and I'll talk about one that I talked to today. And they just start everyone at 0.6. And so anyway, we're moving the doses for the early outpatient treatment a little bit higher. And then also as an adjunct, if you are sick, again, to decrease viral load, get rid of that viral burden, use vericidal mouthwashes and also nasal irrigation. And so if you look here, you can get very common in the pharmacies, you can get 10% povidone iodine. You have to dilute it to get down to 1%. We have little instructions there. So make it a little bit more dilute, and then you can irrigate the nose with it. And so if you do nose as well as oral rinses, the studies show much lower rates of hospitalization and worsening. So really easy kind of available over-the-counter intervention that you can do to help mitigate worsening. The last thing is, you know, Paul, we'll talk about, you know, I'll have you talk about this a little bit more, Paul, but, you know, I tweeted this week that saying that we were having a little bit more trouble in the ICU. You know, we're having patients come to us in fairly advanced disease. And, you know, we have a very sophisticated and multi-pronged combination therapy protocol called Math Plus for really the hospital and ICU. And even at the highest doses, using all the combinations, we've had a couple of patients who are what's called refractory to treatment. Paul's had a few, Joseph's had a few, I've had a few, and we're resorting now to have to doing our salvage therapy, which is therapeutic plasma exchange, which actually is working. The problem with this is that it's invasive, it's labor intensive, it's resource intensive, and it's not available everywhere. In fact, the hospital where I'm working now, we don't have it easily available. In fact, I think I can get it, but I certainly wouldn't be able to do it to many patients in the unit. Paul has an aggressive service at his hospital, and he's been using it to good effect. Paul, you want to talk a little bit more about your experiences this week and last?
Yeah, so we've this Delta variant is clinically very different from the previous variants. As I said, patients are presenting much earlier. They're symptomatic for a shorter period of time, and they deteriorate or escalate very quickly. So we're finding that when patients present later, they really do not respond as satisfactorily to our Math Plus protocol as they did previously. So what we've been doing is therapeutic plasma exchange. We find this very effective. And this seems to be, you know, obviously it's highly invasive. It's a high resource intervention. But for, you know, for physicians out there, it's something to really consider. It turns these patients around really quickly. So basically, you know, for the you know, the non-medical people, it's a modern form of bloodletting. basically, you're taking out the bad blood, which actually is the plasma. So you're taking out the bad plasma and you're replacing it with good plasma. So in a way, you're taking out the bad humors and you infusing the good humors. So it seems to work quite well in breaking this terribly vicious cycle of inflammation. So what seems to be quite pronounced with this Delta variant is the degree of pulmonary inflammation is truly astonishing. These patients' biomarkers are through the roof and they have profound inflammation. And, you know, the corticosteroids and vitamin C and the rest of the protocol doesn't appear to work as efficiently as it did previously. So when we add the plasma exchange, it looks like it's turning these patients around. But I think the bottom line is that people need to do whatever they can to prevent getting COVID. And if they get infected, as Pierre did, you want to start treatment on day one.
Yeah.
There's no time or place for complacency, because this disease marches on really quickly. And it's a matter of life and death. So I think people need to be prepared.
And Paul, that applies to the unvaccinated who's on ivermectin as prevention. It applies to the vaccinated. There's still a lot of breakthrough infections with the vaccinated. The true extent, we don't know which. We know that not all of the vaccinated are getting as sick in the hospital, but we think that may be a function of time with waning immunity from the last shot. You know, it's important that everybody get prepared for early treatment. So I don't think I want to tell the vaccinated, to be complacent here.
Yes, and I appear absolutely correct. It's not that often that he is. Anyway,
I knew you were going to throw something in.
Yeah. So, you know, whether you're vaccinated or you're not, you're at risk of getting this variant. And I think you need to be prepared. And so, you know, the protocol works for both vaccinated and unvaccinated. And I think what's important is that it's not just, it's a multimodality therapy. You know, it's all the components that together seem to work well. The ivermectin, the vitamin C, the vitamin D, the melatonin, and obviously the mouthwash and mouth goggle, which is such a simple thing to do. I mean, it's just common sense that you have a high viral load in your throat and nasopharynx, and just using some antibacterial goggle and rinse can go a long way in reducing the viral load, because it seems that it is the viral load which determines how infectious the disease is and how it progresses. So the severity of the disease is related to the viral load. So
and anything keep in mind, Paul, I'm going to jump in and remind folks that, you know, our paper, which was the rationale for our hospital protocol, which is our first protocol that we came together and put, we've had plasmapheresis in there as a salvage therapy ever since, actually, in Paul's unit, when they had a couple of refractory patients, I think last June or May. They tried plasmapheresis with a really abrupt turnarounds. And in this paper, I did a review of the world's literature, and there were numerous case reports and case series from around the world where they were describing patients who were refractory to treatment. They were doing everything. Many had gotten tocilizumab and corticosteroids and remdesivir. And once they started plasma exchange, they also noticed very tight, temporally associated turnarounds. And in fact, there's three cohort studies, observational, not large, but they have about 74 patients with really dramatic results. So the best one was from Pakistan, because they did a propensity score matching. So they found 45 very well-matched patients. And they noticed that the mortality was 9% versus almost 40%. And then similarly here, you had 0 versus 35% mortality in a smaller trial. So it can have really profound benefits in refractory cases. And that's why we talked about it tonight. Before we get to questions, one thing that we're going to be working on, because again, plasmapheresis is not for everyone. You know, it requires the insertion of a large catheter. It requires the resources of a blood bank. You need a lot of albumin product to replace the plasma that you take out. And it's also not available everywhere. I've been talking with the doctor who has, there's a trial of a TMPRSS2 pathway, an anti-androgen therapy, which really has shown tremendous results. And I think we're going to talk about incorporating that into our Math Plus as a new strategy that's a little bit more available to everyone. And so I'm going to talk, I'll just go over it a little bit, but I think you're going to hear more from us about this, because again, we want to adapt and evolve. So as the disease gets stronger, we want to respond by getting stronger. And I think this is a new approach that we want to incorporate, not only early, outpatient, but also late. And what happens is there's an enzyme, which is this transmembrane protease, serine 2. And what it does is it actually enhances the binding of SARS-CoV-2 to the ACE receptor. And it's androgen promoted. So if you use anti-androgens, you can actually kind of inhibit this enzyme and affect the binding and entry of SARS-CoV-2 into the cells and therefore the replication. And there's already been a number of trials on that. And so they noticed this first in an observational fashion, where they noticed that patients on androgen deprivation therapy or on 5-alpha reductase for like alopecia, they noticed they fared much, much better in COVID than those who weren't. And so this was just on an observational level. And then they started testing this prospectively. So this was the differences in symptoms if you were on a 5-alpha reductase, which is an anti-androgen. And they saw the biggest differences were anosmia, adusia, which is loss of taste, loss of smell, headache, and cough. Then they tried dutasteride, which is a 5-alpha reductase, a pretty potent one. And they noticed in outpatients that it actually led to a much higher virologic clearance and much higher clinical recovery in outpatients. And then there's a new one called proxalutamide. And this is the one that got a lot of attention because it, you know, that phrase game changer came up around this drug. So first of all, it's not a drug that's available yet. It actually has not passed any regulatory agency in any country. It's actually still under investigation for prostate cancer. But they tried this in COVID, and the results were pretty astounding. So in the one outpatient trial, they noticed that the hospitalization rate was 2% versus 26% in about 268 male patients with mild disease. And then they tested in hospitalized patients. This is males and females. And in 645 patients, half got proxalutamide. The mortality rate was 11% versus 50%. And this was the P1 variant in Brazil. So you saw this dramatic eye-popping reduction in mortality using this anti-androgen therapy. And it got a lot of attention. And so some people feel it's too good to be true. The lead investigator of that trial is Flavio Cattagiani. He's done a number of studies in COVID. I actually got to speak to him today. We've had a number of emails as we got sort of interested in trying to apply this, because I've been trying to get proxalutamide for my patients, but it's not available anywhere. And from that paper, you know, the one study which said it's too good to be true, they commented on this researcher and the fact that he's previously touted unproven COVID-19 medications such as ivermectin and nitazoxanide, which both of them actually have very good evidence bases. And then our friend, or not so much friend, Eric Topol, who's kind of just a tool. I don't even know why he's around. He didn't seem to think it could be true, but because it's not approved in Brazil, they've actually used other combinations, powerful anti-androgen approaches. And so we were just discussing this today. There's some really powerful anti-androgens, and there's a number of combinations that they've been using in Brazil. And Flavio was telling me that they were getting really, really good results with this. So I think Paul and I need a little more time to discuss, learn more about these drugs, but I think this could be a potential new sort of, you know, tool in our Math Plus protocol. So you'll hear more about this from us as we go. And this is their hospital treatment. So they're using it both as an outpatient as well as in hospital. And with that, I think we'll stop. Is that okay?
We have a lot of good questions, a lot of really good and important questions for you. So we can jump in quickly. And, you know, you talked about starting early, and we have a question from Julie Briggs, who said, can I start using ivermectin if I'm feeling ill, or should I just wait until I have a positive COVID test?
So there's two, there's some people who like test and treat, and then there's some who like treat then test. Because of the safety of ivermectin, there's such little downside. I think it's totally reasonable to do treat then test. So you can start treatment as soon as you feel like you have anything that's resembling a viral syndrome coming on. Because, you know, again, the message tonight is that this thing moves fast and time matters. Early treatment is key. And so I would not wait to find out that you have COVID if you think you have COVID. So I think it's reasonable to start immediately. Do you disagree, Dr. Marek?
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, if you have a flu-like illness, whether it's flu or whether it's COVID, makes no difference, actually. It just so happens that ivermectin has activity against flu. The likelihood is that it is COVID, you know, and if it turns out not to be COVID, you've really lost nothing.
Nothing.
But if you haven't, you know, hours count, days count. So it makes so much more sense to have it available. If you have a flu-like illness, just start taking it. I mean, there's no downside, you know, because this disease marches on really quickly.
That's so good to hear. And by the way, is there any downside to taking it twice a week?
Not that we know of. I mean, we know people, we know many, many large populations of people who've been taking it once a week for many months now. You know, we know it's a safe drug. We've had patients taking it every day for 5 to 10 days when they're ill. I don't imagine that there's going to be a problem twice a week. If we find data otherwise, we will share it. But we wouldn't have gone there if we thought it was dangerous.
Yeah, I know people who take it daily, actually. But I think what's important is people have to do a risk stratifying. So if you're at a high risk, it becomes much more important to take it twice a week. You know, if you're a low risk person who, you know, not in contact with a lot of people, socially distance, you know, I think it becomes less of an important issue. So it does depend upon your risk. So people should, you know, risk stratify themselves.
Okay, we have Eileen Orr says, our children are headed back to school this week amidst a local outbreak of the COVID-19 Delta variant in Northeast Florida. My husband and I have ivermectin on hand. However, our 4 children are between the ages of 8 and 2 years old. Should we treat children with ivermectin or just the adults? And if children are included, what would the dosage be? Thank you, she says.
Hey, Pierre, you want to take that one?
You know, I was about to give that to you. We don't like children questions. We're adult doctors. You know, I mean, I'm going to give my opinion, maybe a little different from Paul. You know, I still think at those ages, what were the ages, Betsy?
Between 2 and 8.
Oh, 2. 2 and 8. They tend to fare pretty well with this. I probably wouldn't push it. You know, ivermectin is supposed to be safe for anyone over 6 months old. But I guess it's risk benefit. I don't know.
I don't think we have enough data. You know, I would just do sensible, you know, social distancing. They can certainly gargle with a mouthwash. They could take their vitamins.
Yeah.
You know, I probably wouldn't do.
Kids love gargling with mouthwash, Paul.
Yeah, especially if it's peppermint flavored or something nice. So, I mean, it seems such a, get the kids to gargle, give them their multivitamins, their vitamin D, you know, and I still think that, you know, we're not through this pandemic. So one has to adopt, you know, reasonable, you know, measures in terms of group outings and people collecting together in small spaces, you know, so social distancing and wearing masks, I think still is important.
We have a question from Ronan Collet. It just disappeared on me, but it came back. How do the ICU doctors tell the difference between breakthrough cases and a DE, which I guess is antibody disease enhancement?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So to date, while it is a possibility, so what ADE stands for is antibody enhanced disease. So that the antibody, rather than being protective, actually potentiates or make the disease worse. So while this is a potential problem, we don't really have good data that it actually is is happening in reality. Would you agree with this, Pierre?
Yeah, I mean, I'm confused by the data in that it seemed suggestive from Israel and the UK when they started showing more people in the hospital with who are vaccinated, especially more severely ill, but it's still not definitive. I mean, there's more people who are vaccinated there anyway. And so, yeah, it's not clear to me how much it's occurring. I think some have cautioned for it, but yeah, it's essentially, it would be worse disease in people who are vaccinated. It would potentiate and make them worse. We're not seeing that now in the US. Right now, the numbers are more unvaccinated in the ICUs, at least in our, I don't know, public data is not really that easy to get. But in our own experiences, in my discussions with my colleagues in the ICUs, it's generally more unvaccinated now. But that's not the case in other countries, and that may change as we go on.
Yeah, so with ADE, you would expect people who were vaccinated to have more severe disease, whereas the converse seems to be the case, that people who've been vaccinated who have breakthrough infections appear to have less severe disease. So we don't know. It is a possibility. It is a theoretical possibility. We're just going to have to see how this progresses. But at this time, we really don't think that ADE is a major problem.
Okay. We have Marcia Tanaby wants to know, would you please advise whether the FLCCC protocol for both prevention and treatment can be adjusted for a pregnant woman in her third trimester?
So there's no studies showing the safety of ivermectin in pregnancy. However, in the clinical studies, in the reviews of the many instances where pregnant women have taken ivermectin, there is no there's no safety signal, meaning there's no actually danger signal. So it's considered safe, although it's not definitive, right? And so, you know, it's very hard to say any drug is safe in pregnancy. There were some birth defects in animal studies at very high doses of ivermectin. So I think that gave some people pause. But again, in human, the history of human use in pregnant patients, it's considered safe. Now, however, we have to be cautious. If you're sick, I think the risk-benefit ratio changes greatly. Meaning if you're sick with COVID, I think it would make the use of ivermectin to be highly recommended, whatever trimester you're in, because I think the best thing for the baby is a healthy mother. You preserve the health of the mother, and that's how you help the baby the best. But where the equation changes is prophylaxis. So prophylaxis, taking it every week, or as we're saying now, twice a week over time during a pregnancy, I'm sorry, but all bets are off there. I don't know that that's safe, and I wouldn't want to find that out. So on the prevention part, I would say I would avoid. But if you're sick, and on the treatment part, I would say it's indicated.
Yeah, I would agree with Pierre. I think pregnant women should do whatever they can not to get COVID. I think that's the bottom line. COVID and pregnancy just do not go well together. So pregnant women should take all precautions. You know, if somebody in the family has COVID, they really need to keep away from contact with people with COVID. They really need to socially distance. They need to wear masks. They need to do everything else, the vitamin D, the gargling, whatever they can do to prevent getting COVID, because COVID and pregnancy is a terrible combination. So I think pregnant women is just one of those things. They have to be vigilant and, you know, keep away. It's not a time for socializing and not a time to be in contact with a lot of people and in people who have COVID.
Okay. Nicole Smith wants to know, she said, I am currently on the preventive ivermectin protocol. If I am exposed to COVID-19, can I spread it to others regardless of whether I have active symptoms or not?
Yeah, where are we with asymptomatic spread, Paul? I consider that there is pre-symptomatic spread, meaning that you can spread it in the days before you develop symptoms. In fact, some would argue, I think there's some data showing that that's the highest spreading rates is just before you show symptoms. But if you don't have symptoms and you're on ivermectin prophylaxis, I don't think you're at high risk of spreading. But I don't know that I have specific data on that. Paul, you want to?
Yeah, I think the risk of spreading is related to your viral load. So I think if you're taking ivermectin, you're likely to have a much lower viral load and you're less likely to spread it. So I think that people who take ivermectin are less likely to spread to other people.
Okay. Yep. Denise Devotee wants to know, why are children getting COVID more now? I'm a nurse in South Florida and it's horrible. What can we do to help the pediatric population?
Oh, yeah. So that's really, you want to take this one?
Well, no, Pierre. So it's a really, I mean, she is right. And the data is absolutely true. If I look in our ICU, these are much younger people. So for reasons that are unclear, I'm not sure if we know exactly why this variant is going for younger people. It may be because the elderly people have already had COVID or the elderly people are vaccinated or for some other reason. I don't have a good explanation why COVID is going for younger people. Pierre, do you have a good reason?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to sound ominous, but, you know, some of the virologists have predicted this, right? And they have attributed this to the mass vaccination policy in the pandemic, that the more you vaccinate in a highly mutagenic pandemic, it somehow creates a selective escape variants that are more susceptible to young people. I don't know if that's exactly what's happening, but that has been one of the cautions. So if someone's asking us why that's happening, I'm not an expert virologist, I'm not an immunologist, but I have read the arguments that people have predicted before this started to happen. They said, watch out, the more you vaccinate, the more you're going to create variants that are attacking young people. And if those predictions are true, it's really scary because there's a lot of vaccinations going on. And I hope it's not true.
Art Levine would like to know, your group, he says, did great critiques of the WHO paper. Any plans to critique the Cochrane collaboration study analysis that many journalists are citing now?
So I got to tell you, I had a meeting this morning with Tess Laurie, who is, you know, the master researcher, systematic reviewer. She's done more Cochrane library reviews than her team has over decades. Paula, have you ever done one? I've never done one. I'm not a systematic reviewer, but I talked to Tess and I was like, hey, Tess, have you done a rebuttal for that idiotic Cochrane review? And she just said, you know, I'm just too tired. She said she's exhausted. She's tired of rebuttals. She said something encouraging, which I agree with. She says, you know, we're making progress. People are listening. They're understanding. It's just too much to rebut each and every one of these hit jobs. So no, we haven't. The other thing that Tess said is that one of the researchers on her team, Andy Bryant, he was the first author of their recent systematic review. He's on a golf vacation right now, a golf holiday. And he's the Cochrane expert. When he comes back, he's going to do the rebuttal. In the interim, I'll just say that Cochrane review, they looked at 14 trials when we actually have 24 to 27 trials. So they literally looked at half of the evidence base of just the randomized controlled trials. They split it into buckets So they actually just looked at, they looked at like hospital and outpatient differently. So they basically whittled it down into these small evidence bases and found everything inconclusive. It wasn't subtle. It just wasn't subtle. It's just another extremely biased paper. And it's a shame.
So, you know, I think, Pierre, it leads us to, you know, what we've been talking about, the totality of the evidence, because this argument is going to go round and round and round. You know, there will be people who, no matter what you say, will say ivermectin doesn't work, it's ineffective. And they will find studies to support their point of view. But you know what I think you have to do, which is kind of obvious, you have to look at all the evidence. You can't cherry pick the studies that you want.
Paul, can I show your super cool diagram and we'll walk through it? I just want to point out, so when you look at when you're trying to determine the efficacy of a medicine, there's many different sources that you need. Not only do you need a biologic plausibility, but there's many different things that you can study to show that something might work. All of the discussion and all of the attacks are only in this bucket. In fact, nobody in the world, everyone seems to refuse to look at the other sources of evidence. They're only looking at the randomized controlled trials, and they keep complaining that the randomized control, they're small, they're not powered enough. They're poor quality. And so they argue this. But if you look at all of the sources, it is astounding. What we know is that there's 10 years of basic science in vitro studies showing that ivermectin inhibits the replication of many viruses. West Nile, Zika, dengue, influenza, HIV, even SARS-CoV-2. There's animal studies showing that in a model where they had a very similar virus to SARS-CoV-2, which absolutely destroyed the livers of some animals, with ivermectin, it protected the liver from organ damage and also reduced inflammation. In silico, if you don't know what that means, it's computer modeling. And when they do these like artificial intelligence computer modeling studies, looking for the drug that binds most tightly to SARS-CoV-2, guess what drug keeps popping up? It's ivermectin. The pharmacologic studies, first of all, it's an unparalleled safety profile over decades, and that we also have from personal communication that the inhibitory concentration against SARS-CoV-2 in lung adipose tissue is easily reached with standard dosing. So there's no dosing problems, there's no safety problems. And then case series, beginning even last year in June, 3,000 consecutive patients in the Dominican Republic, only one death, only 16 hospitalized, and they all were treated with ivermectin. We now are in a network of many doctors all around the world who report very few treatment failures with ivermectin. And again, ignore the randomized controlled trials, observational controlled trials, 31 of them, 6,800 patients. They keep showing that the prevention trials, profound reductions in your risk of getting it. You don't transmit COVID-19. And it also reduces time to recovery, rates of hospitalization, and mortality. And probably the best of these trials was a propensity match study published in the major journal Chest. And that was done by a group in Florida, in Miami. And they showed as long ago as last year, huge reductions in mortality in the hospital. And then you have 27 RCTs also showing similar outcomes. And then most important it, for me, because never mind these trials, all these trials, even the one that we didn't talk about yet, just before we came on, we heard about the Together trial, which didn't show that ivermectin was statistically significant in improvement. But again, they were treating late and they're treating it with a very short duration. If you actually look at real world studies in Peru, Mexico, Argentina, you're seeing these tremendous impacts. So in this test and treat program in Mexico, they had 50,000 patients that they gave an early treatment kit using a rapid test. Everybody positive got the kit. They compared to the 70,000 who didn't get the kit, and they saw up to a 75% reduction in need for hospital. Another health ministry in Argentina, same thing, large reductions in hospitalization, less ICU or death. And then La Misiones Argentina, they just came out with this. They found, again, 75% reduction in hospital and an 88% reduction in death. And this is a big interview this week with the health minister of La Pampa in their rather smaller trial, which is a test and treat. They show that deaths were reduced by 33%. So we know it works. And if you look at the totality of the evidence, you cannot be confused. I'm really tired about arguing about these randomized controlled trials. Most of the randomized controlled trials, they really fail from one aspect. It's very hard to do early treatment. They have to be tested. Then they have to be identified. They have to be recruited, consented, randomized, and then you give them the medicine. And those are days of delay. And the Together trial was mostly done in Brazil with the P1 variant, which I told you guys, I talked to Flavio Cottagiani. He said that the P1 variant was way worse than the Delta. He says they're not having as much of a problem with Delta with their protocols, but the P1 variant was wicked. And so the fact that randomized controlled trial where they treated people late with the P1 variant didn't show statistically significant results is somewhat unsurprising. So anyway, that's a long answer to a question.
So Pierre, we've been down this road before, you know,
you think?
Clinicians, you know, as clinicians at the bedside, you can see what works and what doesn't work. And your patients can tell you what works and what doesn't work. And so the vitamin C story is a good example because we've seen it, you know, when you see this truly astonishing clinical benefit of vitamin C. But again, it's timing. And the problem is randomized controlled clinical trials, very difficult to replicate or duplicate real world experience.
Yep.
So we know it works. I mean, it works.
People pray at the altar of the randomized controlled trial as the source and harbinger of all truth.
The problem is these trialists, they're not doctors.
Yes.
And I think there's a big difference between someone who sweats at the bedside, you know, at the side of a patient who's dying and treats a dying patient who, you know, then does well. I mean, that's somebody who's at the bedside, someone who looks after real patients, not clinicians or whatever they are, who look after spreadsheets. So, you know, we look after real people. These are people who have mothers and fathers and daughters and brothers. These are not spreadsheets. These are not numbers. And when you treat real people, it's what makes a difference. So, you know, I agree with Pierre. I'm sick and tired of all the naysayers. You know what? They can stick with their spreadsheets. We're going to treat our patients. And the patients, the success of our patients is what keeps us going.
Speaking of patients, Linda Pinty wants to know, what about people who have had organ transplants? Is ivermectin safe for them?
So that's a really good question. So the problem with organ transplants is that they do not respond well to vaccination. So we currently in our ICU have 4 or 5 people post-transplant who've had the vaccine who mounted a very poor response. So vaccination, we know, does not provide good protection. So ivermectin is fine. The only caveat is there's a drug-drug interaction between the anti-rejection medication. So it's therefore very important that you tell your transplant physician that you want to take ivermectin and that he monitors your blood levels of your rejection medication. But there's no reason you can't take it. And indeed, as I've just said, it seems that vaccination does not provide a good protection. We know that even with the third booster, that only about 50% have some degree of immune response. So I think in transplant people, this is certainly something which is worthwhile considering, but should be discussed with your transplant physician. And important to adjust the doses of your medications. Would you agree with that, my friend there?
Yeah, I do. I also had another thought. You know, I really am disappointed. You look much more handsome in the blue than in me in the gray. You didn't tell me blue. It looked like, how did this
happen? I don't know what your problem is. I think it's a colorblind issue.
Maybe it is. I'm sad. Can you send me that one? I'll send you this one.
Yeah, maybe COVID's affect your visual acuity.
It's affected a lot of things. So yeah, I'll believe it. Yeah. Anyway, carry on, Betsy.
Well, I think
there's a lot of good stuff here. So Charles Moo wants to know, is there a good alternative to ivermectin where it is not available, like here in England? We can't even import it.
Well, the options on our protocol are fluvoxamine, which may or may not be easier to get. You still would need a physician to prescribe it. Dutasteride or finasteride is on our Math Plus, but we're going to put it on our outpatient as well. Those are 5-alpha reductase, and they've shown reductions in the need for hospitalization. And so those would be the other options.
You know, I think one shouldn't forget melatonin. You know, people think of it as a sleep medication. It actually is very potent in both protecting and limiting getting COVID. There's also vitamin D. I think people, you know, especially as we're going through summer into winter, people become vitamin D deficient. It's been very well documented that vitamin D deficiency increases your risk. And then, as Pierre said, I think fluvoxamine, and if fluvoxamine's not available, fluoxetine, which we think may be as effective as fluvoxamine. So there are options that people can take. And then obviously the gargling seems such a simple thing to do. Just gargle all the time.
Yep.
So there are things you can do. And I think obviously, you know, you have to be cognizant of the fact that this Delta virus is going around and that this is not a time for, you know, big social events.
Yes. Here's one. Claudia Rosemont says, I worry about the weekly dosing with ivermectin for prophylaxis, since traditionally ivermectin is a once every couple of months or even just once a year dosing. That's for the parasitic diseases, I guess. Is there any research about this more frequent dosing regimen for COVID in terms of its effects on the human body?
Yeah. So let me answer that and then
begin again. Yeah.
So I think that depends upon your risk. So if you are in a situation that you're at a high risk of getting COVID, so, you know, you're a healthcare provider, you're in an environment that you interact with a lot of people, which puts you at a high risk, then I would do it, you know, as Pierre said, you know, twice a week. If your risk is less, then I think maybe you can get away with once weekly. You know, I'm not sure. Pierre may comment on that. So I think, you know.
Well, the question, Paul, was, is there any research or data? And I can only point to the cohorts in Argentina who've now been prophylaxing weekly for many weeks in large numbers. And there has not been any concerns around safety in a large cohort of healthcare workers. And that's in those cohorts. Anecdotally, I know many people who've been taking it weekly over the past year. And again, no one has reported any concerns. And so I think it's safe. It's a very safe drug traditionally. But the questioner is absolutely correct, right? What we know about ivermectin safety has been really on like the one or two dose regimens for parasites. And so we are in a new sort of area, but again, we have not had any concerns around safety of taking it more frequently.
Yeah, so there is some experimental studies where they give ivermectin daily. So it's used for malaria prophylaxis because it actually kills the mosquito and not the malaria parasite. So there is some work with it given daily, and it seems fine. I think the biggest thing that people must be aware of is potential drug interactions. So there are some drugs that will interact with ivermectin. And I think that may be the only caution. It's just if you're on other medications, just check about drug interactions. As far as we know, it appears to be safe.
It's at the top of the hour. Can you scoot over a little bit more? We have a couple more really good questions, I think.
Sure.
All right, good. From Kate Garcia, I had the J&J vaccine in March, came down with COVID in July, and I followed your protocols for 4 days after my first symptoms. I do feel much better now. Is there any reason I need to have ivermectin on hand now?
I mean, probably not for right now, because you have some pretty good natural immunity, it sounds like. But maybe in the future. I don't know, Paul.
So, yeah, I mean, if you've had COVID before, you have some degree of natural immunity, which should provide some protection. You know, I still think that, you know, households should have an emergency kit, which has ivermectin, which should be available for whoever needs it in the family. So, you know, our dream world would be ivermectin in the medicine closet at home.
Yeah, that's a better answer, Paul. You're smart. I like that.
No,
seriously, if it's not for her, maybe for someone in the family or a close friend, it's a good practice just to keep it at home.
And the next question follows up on that. It's from Zoe Metro, who says, how much ivermectin should I ask for in a prescription to have on hand?
I would say minimum is 0.4 milligrams per kilogram for 5 days worth with a refill.
Yep.
But fill it now, bring it home, have that. And that way you can always refill it when you're sick. Minimum.
To find a doctor? Well, of course, we have our telehealth list on the website. We also have just posted a list of pharmacies, because we know that there are people who are having pharmacists who are having problems. Pharmacists won't fill the prescriptions in some places. You may tell them a little bit more about that. I know, Pierre, you've had some experiences with that.
Yeah. So in the last couple of weeks, I hadn't treated anyone for a couple of months in the spring, early summer. And now I'm collecting patients again. Since I don't have an outpatient practice, I'm treating friends of family, colleagues, and friends of colleagues. I've been having more and more trouble getting patients ivermectin. I'm having more pharmacists refuse to fill. I'm getting into really weird arguments. I don't really have time to get to win the arguments. I used to have time to win arguments. I would threaten to, you know, report them and all these things, but it's a new front in this war where we're actually getting obstructed by pharmacists. The answers seem to be going to independent pharmacists, so not in the chains. The independent pharmacists seem to be much more cooperative and supportive. And if you're talking about prophylaxis, we have a few pharmacies on our list where you can do it online without a prescription. So if you can wait, I would order some to have on hand that way, so you don't have to deal with these obstructionist pharmacists. And then we haven't been confirmed on this, but we've heard rumors that some of this is top down, that some of these pharmacy chains may be making company policies against ivermectin, although that hasn't been fully confirmed. So I don't really want to say that as definitive yet, but I wouldn't be surprised when and if it does happen, and I think it would be tragic.
We do have a new pharmacy page on the website, and it has a list of pharmacies that will fill prescriptions, pharmacists that will do it. And so we're going to try to keep that up to date and try to get as many in there as possible so that people will have another resource. But there are quite a few in there already and that deal with different states. The only thing is if you go through them, somebody is going to have to ask some questions because we can't do the shopping and the price comparisons, and we don't know how long it takes for them to ship something to you. And when time matters, as you gentlemen have said, you know, you don't want to have to wait 2 weeks to get something. So you need to ask somebody, how long is it going to take to get to me if I buy it from you right now? And somebody has to be a very smart consumer. Said from the former consumer reporter of CBS News here.
Right.
Okay. That I think is going to do it for this evening. We've gone through, I would say, a nice dozen questions, which is good, and covered a lot of territory. Is there anything else you want to add before we sign off?
I don't know. I think we gave some pretty good guidance. Just stay tuned. We're going to make some more changes to our protocols in the next couple of weeks. And just make them stronger and stay ahead of this virus.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is that this virus is really smart and is outfoxing us, and that people have to be aware of what's going on and be prepared. And we need to react as things change. We can't be complacent. This pandemic is not over. It's unclear when it will be over. We need to be on our guard, and we need to be try and be ahead of this virus, not behind it.
All right. Early treatment, prevention is key, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dr. Merritt, Dr. Corey. We're going to wrap it up, folks. That's all the time we have for tonight. If we didn't get to your question tonight, well, come back next week. We'll be here. And same time, same station. And if you want to keep up with us, meanwhile, you know, we have the website, flccc.net. And we are doing some major rearranging of it. So hopefully those black holes in the video section will be gone soon. We are putting things on Odyssey. We're moving it around, making it easier to find. It takes a lot longer than we thought it would, but it's happening, and there are changes every day. We also, if you want to just see our videos, we have a site on Odyssey. We also have things on Telegram now, if we're taken down on Facebook or Twitter. Obviously, YouTube has done it. LinkedIn took us down.
Hey, wait. I forgot one thing, Beth. Yeah. I forgot the donation.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah. So before you all leave, just remember, guys, we're a nonprofit. We're working all the time trying to stay ahead of this virus and trying to spread a good message of sound medical care. And we have innumerable asks from around the world. We're really proud of the impacts we've had. We're also demoralized by the challenges and attacks we face, especially from a very deep-pocketed opposition, which is a truly historic sadness. So we do need your help. So we're an overworked, still small organization that's growing. So if you like our message and you like our work, please support us to do it better. All right. So thanks, guys. Thanks for thinking of us. And just go to our website, flccc.net. There is a big donate button. So help us out. And we appreciate it. Thank you.
And we thank all of those of you who have done it. And by the way, We want you to sign up for our email list, and that's 8,000 of you did that since last week alone, and 6,000 of you did it the week before. So this is fabulous because, of course, if we do get taken down from other places, this gives us a way to reach you and to let you know about our updates and protocols and the things that we are starting to do. I just wanted to say there is a nice little sign up form. You can just put flcc.net/signup, and you can pass that around to anybody else in the world that you think would like to stay in touch with the information that we are sending out, because that's what we're about. Medical information, saving lives. That's all this is. We're not selling anything. We're just trying to save lives. So thank you all for watching. Get that iMask Plus updated protocol on the website now. It's right there. You can just go to the homepage. And as I said, it's at the top left. You'll see it. Thank you. Have a wonderful week. Stay well. Thank you, doctors. We'll see you all next week.